stupid. He comes across in front of me every single time he overtakes. Where does he want me to go off the track?
No!
Stop talking to me in the braking zone.
It's episode 55 of the Motorsport 101 podcast, and because Hamilton's got a 55-place penalty, I'm recording this podcast from France. Hello and welcome back to episode 55 of Motorsport 101. I am your friendly neighbourhood host, Mr. Andre Harrison. Pleasure to have you with us once again. Now, we're doing things a little bit differently this time around. Hopefully it'll work out. I'll be honest, we've kind of rushed this one. But us being the professional broadcasters we are totally going to wing this and it'll come out beautifully. But first of all, we've got to introduce our usual co-hosts. First up, Mr. Adam Johnson.
Hello. I guess overall, like both on track and off, if Carlsberg did weekends, they wouldn't be this one, but they'd be pretty close.
It'd be pretty good. It'd be a solid Foster's. And on the other side of the scale, from America as ever, Mr. Ryan King. Hello, sir.
Yeah, great motorsport weekend. I mean, wish Simon Pagenaud did a little bit better in Texas, but can't ask for much more.
Like, what is it with you and your backing in the French, King?
Well, Nico Rosberg's not French.
Oh! Whatever, close enough. We'll go with that. That sounded really stupid there, actually. God. That was not my finest hour. But welcome back to Motorsport 101. We're going to get the plugs in good and early so you guys know where to find us. Our main way of backing the show is on Patreon. So if you really, really like us by the time this podcast ends, you can go over there and back us over there. Some really cool perks you can get on top of that as well. If you can't support us financially, of course, that's totally understandable. You can always follow us on our other forms of social media. We are on Facebook at facebook.com/motorsport101. We are on YouTube for exclusive content and highlights. You can go over there at youtube.com/motorsport101. You can check us out on our individual Twitters as well at Harrison101HD. Adam is at AJ_BomberSports and Ryan King is at Ryan Eric King. That's with two Ks. And just a quick note, we are going to have our own exclusive Twitter for the podcast very soon. So by next week, we'll probably have that. Just stay tuned on that one for the time being. Now, before we get into the main meat and potatoes of this episode, and obviously the two big races we mentioned, the Formula One in Belgium and IndyCar at Texas, we're going to introduce a new segment. Basically, the Olympic discussions were so popular, thanks to Adam Johnson's restraining order on Laura Trotz, we have now been legally advised to have an extra segment at the start of the show every week. We're calling this segment Keeping It 101, where we're going to talk about things that aren't necessarily motorsport related, but still kind of cool to talk about anyway. And to start this off, you may have seen this on Twitter. Earlier last week, technically speaking, but Sunday for the Grand Prix, my house got invaded by a certain Adam Johnson. You may have seen that. Isn't that right, Adam?
I mean, you invited me over. I didn't just storm the house. You're like, down on the ground now. We are watching the Grand Prix. Get down, motherfucker.
I got swatted. I got swatted by AJ Bomber Sports.
It was also involved in me selling you my old camera, which filmed most of my stop motions on Team Bomber Sports, yeah, so you can do stuff with that.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that I have bought Johnson's old DSLR. Got the box in front of me now. It's a Nikon D5200.
Not actually. That's the box that my new camera came in. It's a D3100.
Oh, fuck you. You gave me hand-me-down boxes. I didn't even know that.
That false advertising.
At least I didn't lie about what model you got.
I want my money back.
Promise you, I did promise him that it was a D3100.
I forgot to read the small print. Who does that? Johnson was around his house. I've got a new camera, so expect a lot more video and, you know, my face for radio being featured much more predominantly on the YouTube channel in the coming weeks. I have no idea how to work this thing, but I will eventually get around to it. Johnson will probably come around and give me 115 lessons on how these cameras actually friggin' work. They're far too complicated. But
how this thing works.
Yeah, we hung around, we watched the Grand Prix, we ate a ridiculous, almost sickening amount of pizza.
That was good.
Yep. Shout out to Rocco's Pizza in Southall. They are fantastic for what it's worth. Well worth the money. We watched the Belgian Grand Prix together, and then we went to Hammersmith together. We snuck into their university to watch the Robot Wars Grand Final. That was an experience, Johnson, to say the least. Like, I've never seen you drink so much Malibu in one shot.
It was Jack Daniels, actually.
Of course.
Basically, what happened is, I don't know if I mentioned this on the show before, me and a few of my friends have this like little group, which basically started because one of the people actually lives in the flats at Hammersmith. They're like student accommodation. I think they're for all sorts of universities, but mainly it's for the University, I think, of West London, maybe. And she happened to mention after the first episode of the series that there's a screening room downstairs. It's basically a mini cinema. It's got beanbags, sofas, big Very cinema cool. screen, sound, surround sound. Heating turned up way too high and then locked, which was fun last night. But ever since then, I've been going over there with a bunch of people to watch every week. And of course, for last night, I decided to invite Dre along because, hey, he's about as big a Robot Wars nerd as I am. Mm-hmm. And B, it's the grand final, so alcohol was involved. Or in Dre's case, he was in the spirit of drunk.
Yeah, because for what it's up, I don't drink alcohol for the record. So, I was watching other people get drunk. Which is quite frankly, just as entertaining, seeing like a very sweaty Johnson walking around drinking his own body weight in Jack Daniels like he's a member of Epic Mealtime or something.
Pretty much.
It wasn't pretty, but we got there in the end. I'm not going to give
away. I'll tell you what, how good was the show?
It was the best show of the series, and for what it's worth, I'm not going to give away any major spoilers because I don't want to spoil it, obviously, for King and obviously for anybody else that was on the internet who has not seen the final yet. But it was a tremendous final. The battles were fantastic. I want to say the best robot won. I'm not going to say who for obvious reasons, but it was a...
Let's put it this way. The two best robots were in the final, absolutely. And they could barely separate them.
Absolutely. And there was a couple of key game changes in said grand final that made it a very, very interesting fight indeed. Wouldn't have been the judges on that situation at all. But I will say it was a tremendous final, and overall, I think the perfect cherry on top of what's been a fantastic reboot for the series in general. I think me and Johnson have got something special in the works in terms of content regarding this series we're going to do down the road at some point.
Yep.
But to keep it brief, it was I think this reboot struck the chord of just about everybody out there. I mean, the feedback and the reaction on the internet has been superb for the series. It's been almost universally positive. Overall, I think the series was fantastic, and I've not really got any major negatives I can draw on at all for the show, at all. Shout out to Dara O'Brien, shout out to Angela Scanlon, shout out to the entire crew. They were all tremendous. All the teams are fantastic. And the way they produced the series, I was very, very much a fan of it as well. They managed to change the dynamic and change the entire, shall we say, atmosphere and structure of the show, but it still resonated with me, and I was very impressed by that. So BBC,
they basically made a Robot Wars that our 10-year-old selves would have enjoyed on a nostalgia trip, and our grown-up selves also enjoyed too.
Just as a TV show in general, I thought it helped.
Like 10 minutes after the end of the episode, after the end of the series, I just looked at Dre and went, it's 2016 and we just watched a new series of Robot Wars.
I know.
And it was really, really good. Like, it's just so surreal. Like, I could have told my 11-year-old self in 2003, or, well, it would have been 12-year-old in 2004, I could have said, hey, don't worry, they'll bring this back in 12 years' time. And he'd have gone, shut the fuck up. But it was just surreal. Like, this almost had no right to be good, and it was so much better than I think anyone dared to believe it could be.
I can't argue with that in the slightest. Again, only very minor critiques across the board, and just a fantastic show. And I'm more than down for a second series of this. I think just about everybody is. Dara O'Brien kind of hinted at it a little bit, saying there's no official word yet, but he seemed to be very hopeful there was going to be a second series. And I think the BBC would be fools not to have another series next year, because I think, again, there is clearly an audience for this. It's in the slot it was on, it did very well, and again, the feedback from people that have watched has been almost overwhelmingly positive. So, yeah, overall, I think it was very, very much great indeed. King, have you got anything you want to keep it real with before we get into the real show?
Ooh, keep it real with... probably since I wasn't here last week due to unfortunate technical difficulties.
Laptop died.
Actually, oh God, brief story about my laptop. It was supposed to be ready in time for the show. The repair shop told me it would be ready in time for by Wednesday. We recorded that episode on a Thursday. Get shown to the shop on Wednesday, and we're like, so, it's not going to be ready, but it could be ready by tomorrow morning. And I call them in the morning, and it's like, it's still not ready yet, bro. It's still not ready yet. And I did not get it back until the Sunday of the Belgian Grand Prix.
Oh my. Like, any cheap laptop repair shop will tell you that, like, whenever they tell you it's fixed, always add a 2-day margin of error on it. It's never quite done when they tell you it's done. It happens to me all the time whenever I was in, when I went to my local repair shop. Because for those guys that know my YouTube history, I went through a lot of laptops. And so, you know, it can most definitely be a problem. But King, it's back. I'm guessing it's in full working order.
Yes, it's actually better than when I sent it in. Like, actually, it's better before, you know, it broke.
Wow, okay. They upgraded it for you then.
Yes.
Does it now connect to Skynet?
No, it does not connect to Skynet. One thing I want to talk about, since I wasn't on that episode, is the IndyCar calendar. I am excited, yet, you know, hopeful that things will build on upon next year. That they added Gateway, Gateway Raceway Park to the, I mean, Gate, yeah, whatever they call it now. I still call it Gateway Raceway Park.
It's, I think it's Gateway Motorsports Park, I want to say, but I'm not, don't quote me on that.
But you know, they have Gateway. Like, I want to see more ovals on the calendar, especially since, like, the last couple street courses they added in have fallen through. You know, Baltimore, Boston this year, and I know early at the year they hinted that IndyCar wants to go to Oklahoma City. They want to go to OKC on the other side. I mean, in Oklahoma. But it's like, to me, I just want some more ovals. I want Chicagoland back. I want Milwaukee Mile back. Like, if I had to say they had to add a street course, I'd say they need to add the Cleveland Airport
back. Oh, yeah. You utter fanboy. Cleveland Airport. For God's sake, King, how old are you?
Actually, no, I'm right there with him.
Oh, shut up.
Just for the visual of 20 wide into the first turn.
Yes, 20 wide into the first corner.
Just the visual of Helio Castroneves going mad at willpower again. Like I'm here for this. But, yeah, I mean, just how many ovals do you want on this calendar, King?
Oh, God, like, let's see. Milwaukee, Chicagoland, Kentucky, and maybe Kansas Speedway in Kansas City. So that'd be like four more than what's currently on the calendar.
Did you, has the name Michigan been mentioned at all?
Like, obviously, I'd love to see Michigan and its sister track Fontana back, but.
Oh.
Bring back Fontana, goddammit!
I haven't heard anything about Michigan. I think it's more like when it comes to the Detroit area, they're more settled at Belle Isle. They don't want to go, like, to, you know, suburban Brooklyn,
that
Michigan.
That is true, yeah.
Okay, fair enough. That sounds reasonable enough to me, but glad to see that King is also enthusiastic for the calendar. And it does genuinely seem like IndyCar has a plan with this calendar going forward. There's definitely more of an oval feel to it, and they've already said that every track on the calendar has got long-term deals in place beyond 2017, which is also a good sign in terms of consistency. So,
yeah, like one thing that I always find surprising, like even since the quote-unquote merger between Champ Car and IndyCar, the oval races always get higher TV ratings than the road course races.
That is interesting. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean, given what happened last weekend, I think it's quite easy to see why they can very well have that sort of potential. But yeah, I can definitely see that being a thing. So, now we've kept it real, let's talk about the Formula One and let's talk about...
Ooh, one more thing.
Oh, go on, Johnson.
One more thing. One more thing and keep it at 101.
Go on.
After I was coming home, or when I was on the tube home from the Robot Wars final, there's very few things that stop me watching NASCAR, but Robot Wars was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, who wins his first bloody race in the race that I'm not watching because it's Robot Wars on? It's only bloody Carl Larson.
The wonderkind.
And literally, it was Marcus Hoare, who's a friend of the show, who tweeted me and was like, can someone check on AJ? Carl's finally done it. And I'm like, I literally was like fist pumping on the tube. It was like half empty, but the people that were on that tube were like, wow, that guy's very happy for 10:38 p.m. on a Sunday night. I was like, you have no idea.
He was abnormally happy. I had to sit there on the chair. Oh, geez.
Simply because at this point in time, when Carl Larson will get his first win is almost like NASCAR's equivalent of when's Nico Hulkenberg going to get his podium.
Yeah, like Dre, just so you know, up until last Sunday, in his third full season in the Sprint Cup, he had 9 top 3 finishes.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
And especially right now in the sort of win on your in era of the chase, damn, you need wins more than ever.
Jesus.
Yeah, wins are everything.
So 9 seconds in third places, but no win. He's basically Nick Heinfeld.
Well, not anymore. He's finally got that win. And
sorry,
it was
Nick.
So good to see. Like, I ended up watching the final 10 laps again, like a rerun when I got the train back home to Swanley, and it was good. It was good stuff. So, King, the chase for this year is looking very interesting considering we have, what, 12, 13 drivers locked in?
Yeah, 13 drivers locked in on wins. Plus, you could have Larson v. Chase Elliott in the chase.
Oh, that'll be good stuff. And the interesting thing is, some of those guys locked in now because Tony Stewart's climbed back into the top 30 in points after his injuries early in the season. He's got a win. He's in. Chris Buescher is 7 points to the good in the top 30. He's got that shock win at Pocono. He's in. Like, this is one of the most balmy chase grids ever, and we've still got 3 slots potentially open.
Yeah, and it's like the playoffs that everyone wants to see. You got Jimmy in the chase, you got Denny Hamlin, you got both the Busch brothers, you got Brad Keselowski, you got Kevin Harvick, which last year's chase, let's not mention that. It's gonna be one hell of a chase.
The format still sucks. Next.
Yeah, format still sucks. But the drama, though. The drama.
The drama.
I mean, what I've said before about the chase format as it stands is that, logically, it's the dumbest fucking thing in all motorsport.
Mm.
But on a purely emotional, dramatic, kind of WWE-esque level, if you can check your brain, it's almost like the Fast and Furious series at this point. If you analyze it in any way, it completely falls apart. But hang out over there for 2 hours.
I directly compare this to like WWE and the Royal Rumble. Like, to determine who's like the number one contender for the championship at WrestleMania, like, the Royal Rumble is like the most ridiculous thing, but it's so extravagant and so over the top that you can't help but watch.
Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it.
I see. I'll let you boys have your fun. Let's talk about the Belgian Grand Prix. Oh boy. Now this was kind of captivating, really, for all the wrong reasons.
I tell you what, it was enjoyable watching it with you. I feel like it was more entertaining because we watched it together. Sorry, King.
I just swore at everything. Like just. I was like, F this.
Literally,
let's
talk about that start, shall we? Just Dre sat there like, oh, this is a good start. This is a good start. This is going, no, fuck's sake. And then there's me going, is that Hulkenberg? No, is that Perez in third? No, that's Hulkenberg. He's third. Verstappen's limping. Hulkenberg's second. That's the actual noise I made.
It actually was. I don't want to talk about this, but it happened. I mean, Nico Rosberg qualifies on pole. He actually had a bit of a harder time than people would imagine because Verstappen and Raikkonen put up some pretty good laps to get themselves within a couple of tenths. But Rosberg starts, gets a clean break. He's off into the distance. And Verstappen gets a terrible launch from second, which is weird because he was on the super soft tire to start. You thought he'd have better traction off the line, but he has a misfire. He does not start particularly well. Vettel is sweeping round the outside. Verstappen is beyond the curb at La Source now. He's got two wheels on the rumble strip, very close to the wall. Kimi Raikkonen is in a free wide sandwich at the apex, and Raikkonen's got nowhere to go. Verstappen loses a chunk of his front wing. Kimi's car, remarkably, is pretty much... because they destroyed the underfloor of the car. They had to go for a pit stop. And Vettel's spun out from the back as well. It's all sorts of car. And as you heard, Nico Hülkenberg got up to third. Ricciardo was up to second. where do we even begin with this one, King?
I want to start at Verstappen because it feels like the whole situation between the Ferraris would have been a lot, you know, less damaging to their races if Max Verstappen wasn't involved.
Most likely. I mean, Verstappen, he went, like, I could see what he was trying to do, but I don't think he had any real chance of making that stick because the line he was taking was so narrow. He'd have to have gone so slow around the apex of that corner that, like, Vettel would have probably swept around him and be second by Rathalon, more than likely. But
yeah.
But, you know, Verstappen's car is there. Vettel's trying a pretty sweeping line through turn three. Obviously, he's going to take as many liberties as he can. Raikkonen's got nowhere to go. It's chaos. And, yeah, I mean, I don't want to apportion blame for this one because, like, it's hard to pin blame on anybody for a turn one incident, especially when there's almost no run down to said turn one. It's pretty much, if you have a shitty launch, God rest your soul, basically.
Yeah, like, to me, Max Verstappen was over-aggressive, but it wasn't anything worth, you know, penalizing or having an investigation over.
Agreed.
Yeah, you're always going to get people going right hard on the first turn because they know it's one of the best chances of the entire Grand Prix to make up position. So,
I feel like the whole story, I do have some problems with Max Verstappen, which we'll probably discuss later.
I think we all do. We'll get to Mr. Verstappen. Mister, I don't think I have any problem. Me, sir? No, sir. That's everyone else, sir. No, everyone else has the problem with me, not me.
Johnson, you should be ashamed of yourself for making those comments.
Of course, mister, I just did an entire dray brief about this. The first corner incident for me is summed up as if either guy on the left or right isn't there, we don't have this issue.
Agreed.
Because basically, it's almost like Vettel turned in expecting Raikkonen to have room to move on the inside.
Yep.
Verstappen goes in on the inside that hard. He's going over the rumble strips and sort of understeering off because he's jumping over them.
Yep.
But he's like, it's okay. Raikkonen's got room to move. No, he hasn't. So, or was it? Yeah, was it Raikkonen in the middle? Raikkonen's just sat there like, lads, I can't disappear. What the fuck are you doing?
it's basically like a really shitty accordion player at this point. It's like they've all just come together, and yeah, it's chaos. And next thing you know, they're all down the back of the field. Lewis Hamilton's smiling to himself internally, like, yes, I got a first quarter break, and the race continues. I mean, they had to go from the back of the field, basically. They all had to pit for you know, to fix their cars, respectively. Again, nothing terminal, luckily, in this case. All just superficial damage that could have been repaired in a pit stop. They go on. At this point, we're going, oh, yeah, Rosberg's got this in the bag then. Nico Hülkenberg is somehow in second place. we're all still kind of in
shock. I'm going nuts.
Yeah, Johnson's lost his damn mind at this point. Ricciardo is third. And about five laps later, Kevin Magnussen. Oh, boy.
this was ugly.
People forget why people think that, oh, Rouge is so easy. Anyone can do it. Why do people love it so much?
Yeah, can I just point out, Tiffany Dell, because you're the one I'm not picking on you personally, but you're the one I remember you specifically saying this. Oh, Rouge is not a fucking straight line, flat out fest. It's still one of the most challenging corners in the world. Kevin Magnussen, QED.
QED. And Kevin Magnussen has a... He drives over the curb at Eau Rouge. He has an enormous snap of oversteer. Note, this is at 190 miles an hour. He has an enormous snap of oversteer. He spins it. Obviously, there's no way in hell he's going to correct that. You would need about another 2 miles of runway with a great big brown line going down from the underside of the car at this point. But yeah. He's gone hard into the barrier at the top of Eau Rouge. Safety car came out. Eventually, it was red flagged because the barrier needed time to be fixed. No problems with it where that's concerned. Completely sensible decision where that was. Luckily, Magnussen was able to walk out of that. Again, only a sore ankle. Luckily, Magnussen has since been released from hospital. He will race in Monza by the time this goes out. But luckily, it was nothing serious. He walked out of the car under his own power. I thought that was just incredible. And again, a testament to these cars. I mean, that car was a complete utter write-off, and he's walking out of it like it's no big deal.
It wasn't no big deal. At first, he was walking on his own just fine. Then the adrenaline just wore off and he needed someone to help because of his ankle. It's like, oh shit, I hurt my ankle.
It's like, oh, my foot. his foot just completely gave out. Bless him. But again, relatively speaking.
Just to be the smarky F1 fan at the moment, he ran over the curb at Radion.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All right, King, plus one. Johnson's gone full. He's the full Radelon Eau Rouge guy right now. He's that guy. What guy? That guy. But Magnussen, again, very lucky to be able to walk over that. Because if you see the replay of the accident, the head support behind Magnussen's car completely flies off when he hits.
That was scary.
When he hits the barrier. And the FIA has obviously seen that's not what should be happening at all. So I think they've already carrying out an investigation as to why that happened. Hopefully we'll get some answers on that one, because that was probably the scariest part of the accident. Yeah. The head support just went completely flying. It was found 15 feet away from where the car stopped moving.
It's a weird situation because, you know, I think his helmet actually struck the headrest, but like the headrest has to be fixed to the car, but it has to be able to be removed without any tools.
All right, so yeah, it has to be kind of easy to remove in case a driver's probably trapped or something, I'm figuring, logically speaking. So, yeah, I mean, it was a massive, massive accident. Luckily, Kevin, relatively speaking, is okay. He was sent to hospital for some precautionary checks. Turns out he was released the same day, just a sore ankle, according to Kevin's own Twitter. Again, all smiles all around. Best news to come out of that race weekend for sure. As we mentioned, safety car was deployed. Race was red flagged as a result to fix the barrier. It was about a 15-minute delay to fix the barrier. Now, we saw the controversial nature of the red flag rule come into play, like we saw in Australia earlier this season, where you're allowed to work on the car in a red flag situation, including changing of tyres. Now, what's the biggest benefactor here for Lewis Hamilton, who won driver of the day for finishing third, was the fact that a lot of cars had already gone through the pits to put on new tyres, obviously because of a safety car. They're thinking, oh, maybe we can turn this two-stopper into a one-stopper. And then they red flag it, so that effectively their pit stop is now effective. They've lost track position now because they can't get that pit stop back anymore. And the big winners in that were Lewis Hamilton, who was 11th, and all of a sudden he was now running 5th, and Fernando Alonso, who was running 4th from the back of the grid, had all of a sudden been able to put on soft tyres, had benefited from all the other runners in the field putting on fresh rubber, and they could start effectively a brand new race, so to speak, from 4th and 5th. King, I was not amused at this news.
I mean, them be the rules. Like, that's all I can say.
Them be the rules, bro.
Because, like, if you watch, you know, I know we're going to talk about this later. If you watch IndyCar, like, that's a common thing. Like, yellow flag comes out, it might as well be, like, a whole new race.
basically. Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about that from Texas later. But it was a whole new race, essentially, and Hamilton had basically been given a fresh start from fifth on the grid. And much to Johnson's fury, he ended up making light work of Nico Hülkenberg to eventually finish in third. That was the highlight of Hamilton's race, passing Hülkenberg twice. I mean, Johnson will never be best pleased about this, were you?
I just love the fact that was apparently enough for him to win driver of the day. Yeah, well done. You beat a Force India twice. Who beat you off pit road as well? That's why he had to pass him twice. He beat him in the pits as well.
21st, like King, we should be ultra impressed with the ability of Lewis Hamilton. He was able to go from 21st to 3rd while only passing 4 cars. He's a genius.
Yeah, I mean, he's in a Mercedes, though. I mean, he is, like, the best driver alive. Like,
yeah, it kind of helps, you know.
Hashtag ham best capers.
apparently, you can't not like Lewis Hamilton, but still, you know, acknowledge that he's one of the best drivers in the world.
I've been saying that for a year and a half. Why do people listen to you and not me on this, King?
I don't know.
Here's a serious point, though, guys. Mm. I mean, before the race, everyone seemed to be really making a big deal out of Hamilton going to the back.
Mm.
And I was saying all along, I'm expecting him to finish maybe second. I was expecting a podium easily. And even afterwards, like Andrew Benson in his report for BBC Sport, he said, few people predicted that Hamilton would get a podium finish out of this. I said, I was just sitting there thinking, please don't tell me I was the only one who thought that. Seriously, we've seen Hamilton start at the back or start from disadvantaged positions before. When Mercedes are just that good, he's probably guaranteed a top three or at least a top five no matter where he starts, isn't he?
As long as everything runs well on the car. I'll give you some examples. Hungary 2014, started from the back, spun on the opening lap, finished third. Germany 2014, started from the back, finished third, one position, like one DRS zone away from beating Bottas for second. You know, it's happened before where a Merckx was actually, for some reason, strangely enough, in Hamilton's case more often, where they've had to drive from the back and Hamilton salvaged podiums on multiple occasions. So, like, I don't know why people are so surprised that Hamilton was able to get on the podium, especially given he is, one, the best driver in the world, two, drives the most overpowered F1 car we might have ever seen, and three, all he had to do, like, basically, he had all the hard work taken away by the red flag. So,
yeah. Like, yeah, cars falling off on the opening lap, he had the red flag.
It seems people, like, number one, people overestimate how well the Red Bulls actually are, and number two, think that since Red Bull's doing good, everyone else in the field must be, you know, somewhere near them, when you gotta realize, like, most of the rest of the cars in the field might not even be there to lose Hamilton.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the top six in the field right now with Red Bull, Merckx, and Ferrari are so much better than everybody else right now that, like, the top six is almost its own separate race at this point. I mean, like, Hamilton came out behind Hülkenberg after his second and final stop, and he was 2.3 seconds behind Hülkenberg. He passed him 2 laps later. I mean, what is the point? Like, what are we really talking about, Hamilton? Like, I'd have had no complaints if Alonso had won driver of the day, given that, you know, we like underdogs. I voted for Nico Hülkenberg personally in fourth place.
I think it was just to appease me because I was in the same room as him.
Well, I have to do something to make up for your. Shitty mood.
Actually, I wasn't that. I'll be honest with you. I wasn't that displeased with Hulk. I was like, well, I know it's unlike. I was like, I know it's probably unlikely he's going to be able to keep the podium, especially after the red flag. I was like, well, the podium's gone. But hey, fourth and then fifth, my other boy Perez. I'll take it. It was about as good a day as Force India could have had. I mean, Dre, you use a phrase sometimes. Correct me if I'm wrong on it. They took pretty much all the points that were available to them on the table.
Pretty much.
I don't know if it's a specific kind of phrase you use, but that's the kind of thing that, like, was about as good a race as Force India could have expected, surely. Especially as it meant they're now ahead of Williams in the constructors, which was enough to make brother Ryan defect permanently from Williams, which I thought was hilarious.
Yes, he no longer supports Felipe Massa. He is now apparently a day one Ricardo fan. much to Ryan King's bemusement, because he hates the Daniel Ricciardo bandwagon like a passion of a thousand suns.
Yeah. Next thing you know, brother Ryan's gonna be like, I've been repping Daniel Ricciardo since HRT.
That's exactly.
He did try and claim that. We were like, nah.
Yeah, we were on the way to the pizza shop, and that's exactly what he tried to claim unsuccessfully. Yeah, that's exactly what happened, basically. So we're all delighted. But hey, props to Force India, their second best ever weekend as a team. The last time they had a day as good as this was Bahrain 2014, when Perez got on the podium, as well as Hülkenberg finishing in fifth. But a really, really good day for Force India. I've said it before, best team in Formula One, pound for pound for me. Like the fact they are now ahead of Williams and could finish fourth overall this season is a tremendous achievement for this team that just keeps finding a way to get better and better. It's
they are effectively the best independent team in Formula One right now, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think so. I mean, Williams has been very uninspiring the last four or five rounds. I mean, they've completely fallen off the top three where they were for the last couple of years. They've slipped massively. I've said it before, I don't think people enough are talking about that enough, quite frankly. I think it's gone under the radar a little bit it's gone off the radar. It's not been talked about enough that Williams was like a top tier player challenging for wins a couple of years ago, and are now maybe not just falling behind the top the other big three, but also Force India and McLaren are starting to bear down on them now, where like people are still acting like Alonso in the points is a surprise. It's not. Like, I know that was Alonso's best performance of the year by finishing in seventh, but like, why are people surprised that McLaren are scoring points now? They've massively improved compared to last year.
Because they're finally starting to get some returns on investment.
Because they want to be surprised, because they want a McLaren return to be a return to the podium, not a return to the points.
Yeah, standards, I suppose. Standards and practices, I guess. But let's talk a little bit about Nico Rosberg real quick. We have to talk about this. Again, a dominant win from the front. Very, very easy for Rosberg. I didn't have to worry about a damn thing all day long, really. Like, I've never seen a race winner get such little time on the hard camera. I think ever in a Grand Prix. But again, his sixth win of the season, that's matching his career best for wins in a season. That's his sixth of the year. He's now the 16th member of the 20 win club in Formula One. He is now joint 14th on the all-time wins list with Kimi Raikkonen, and so much to the 90s fan Shaglan, Mika Hakkinen.
Yeah.
So 20 wins. And, you know, everybody loves, everybody loves Mika Hakkinen. He's like the real people's favorite in a world of Schumacher fans. Get a guy that can be both, basically. And that was Mika Hakkinen. he just shut up at King's house. But that's quite the achievement, Mr. King. I mean, this is all yours, man. You can take this one.
Oh God. Like,
talk to your people. 20, these are your people now.
20 wins is great and all, you know, tying a two-time world champion. Mm. But I still want that world championship under Nico Rosberg's belt so bad.
It's the validation. Like nobody really wants to be the greatest to have never won a title. I don't care what you Stirling Moss fans want to tell me. You would have traded most of those 16 wins in for a world title. Don't even act. Like, half of them are just mad that Moss legitimately gave a title up because of his sportsmanship.
I don't know.
Can I just say, Dre, it's funny you mentioned about that, because we were talking about this on Sunday, and the more you do the comparison between Nico Rosberg and Stirling Moss, the more it holds up. And I'm not just talking about the fact they both drove for the Silver Arrow.
And they're both company guys.
And they're both company guys, absolutely.
And they're both thoroughly outclassed by their teammate. Like, Stirling Moss had to deal with one by Mel Fangio as a teammate, and Fangio beat him 3-0 head-to-head in their respective careers. And Rosberg is currently 0-3 against Lewis Hamilton head-to-head in their respective careers so far. So
basically, both of them have had to deal with being really, really good, but being teammates to one, probably the best of their generation.
Exactly, and therein lies the big problem with Nico Rosberg. I mean, nobody really wants to be the best that's never won a world title discussion. I mean, look at MotoGP, look at Dani Pedrosa, who's won 28 top flight MotoGP races, and he hasn't got a world title to his name. And this is his 12th year in the top class. I mean, that's just like this that kind of like, you don't really want to be that guy, really. It's like, can I just fluke a world title instead, like Kimi Raikkonen did? No,
he's basically going to end up being F1's Mark Martin.
That just sounds like all kinds of miserable to me right there. I wouldn't want that. But again, props to Nico Rosberg. I mean, again, fuck anyone that is booing him on the goddamn podium. Like, why is this still
a thing? Oh my god.
Like, is it
seriously? I love the fact he's just so polite on the podium. Like, he's getting to the point where he'd be well within his rights to pull like a willpower double bird on the crowd. Or just go full Bret Hart on them. Just be like, you guys never supported me. Kiss my ass. Yeah, it's just a mark of Rosberg's character that he doesn't do that.
Yeah, he's far too polite and, you know, too much of a class act to really, you know, do something like that, which is a damn shame, because it's just so utterly disrespectful for that to be happening in Formula 1. I've never understood why somebody would pay £200-400 maybe to go to a Grand Prix, to stand there on the home straight right next to the podium and boo somebody who's, you know, risked his life for your entertainment. I it gets on my fucking tits that this is still a thing. Like, I thought we got over this in 2013 when Sebastian Vettel got booed for 10 straight rounds when Multi-21 happened, and it took Martin Brundle literally calling the fans out during the podium celebration and a bunch of very prolific names in F1 like Ross Brawn, like Nico Rosberg, like Lewis Hamilton, like Jenson Button, all coming out saying, this is getting ridiculous, this has got to stop, it's just, it makes the sport look bad, and that's what it took for it to stop. And we're getting this now whenever Hamilton wins, whenever, like, this is not driver specific, this is just happening now, every single round. It's happened with Hamilton in Austria. Now, that might have been the track announcer's fault. It's happened, you know, it happened in Britain. It's happened now here with Rosberg again. And I don't, for the, like, are they just mad that Verstappen didn't get on the podium, given that Verstappen was just his fault?
Like, to me, I want to say it's generally the fans are frustrated with the sport as a whole.
In what sense do you say?
I don't know. Maybe the competition? I feel like that's being charitable.
Yeah, that it's lack of competition. That when you know, the guy who always succeeds, it feels like when your guy doesn't succeed, it's more like he didn't succeed because he got screwed over by someone else.
Yeah. I mean, we are dealing with a situation. I mean, I said before, a lot of Red Bull's dominance between 2010 and 2013 was kind of a myth. Like, it really wasn't as straightforward as, oh, Vettel dominated for 4 years, won all these titles, you know, it was trying to kill the sport. Game Riot. in many arguments me and him had over the years talking about this, where, like, the actual reality was Red Bull dominated for maybe a year and a half out of the four, whereas two of the seasons were ultra competitive, two of the most competitive seasons we've ever seen in Formula 1. But in this case, Mercs have only lost 7 times as a team in this hybrid era since 2014 began. We've had 51 hybrid era races. Mercs have won 44 of them. That is a run of dominance we have never before seen in Formula 1, where 2.5 seasons now, they've looked practically unbeatable, to the point where Mercs winning a Grand Prix is 1-10 odds every single weekend. You have to gamble a tenner to get back 11 quid. I mean, that's how.
I mean, look at this. The fact that we were talking earlier about Lewis Hamilton starting on the back row of the grid, and we none of us were surprised that he still got a podium.
The odds on a Hamilton podium finish on Sunday was 5-4, barely even money. Like the bookies did not want to take the chance on this because they know just how good this car is. They know how overpowered it is, and then, like, I get that if you're frustrated with the sport, then that's perfectly understandable. Booing the drivers is not going to solve the problem. Like, there are better ways to outlet your frustration. Like, hack Will Buxton's account or something. There's better ways of doing this.
We're not condoning that either.
Well. But like, I don't like the drivers being used as the outlet of frustration. I get it. The drivers are the, you know, they're the relatable side of Formula One, and even that's debatable sometimes, given how, you know, there's an evident distance between us and drivers on that kind of interaction level. I mean, it's not like IndyCar where Hinchcliffe can wish me a happy birthday on Twitter, and that's like the highlight of my day. You're not going to get that in Formula One. You know, they're like, there is still that blatant divide there, and it's frustrating to say the least that that's actually still a thing. Speaking of divide and fans, Max Verstappen again. This is the third round in a row I've got to talk about Max Verstappen. I don't like talking about this because the story doesn't seem to change very much. It's just the context and the nuance that keeps changing. But we talked about turn one. We just about gave Verstappen the benefit of the doubt for that one. The feud with Kimi Raikkonen. I mean, King, you take the reins on this one because I don't even know where to go from here on this one.
Oh God, where Kimi Raikkonen said he, you know, Verstappen's going to have a dangerous accident to the press, and Max Verstappen said that, you know, Raikkonen as well as Sebastian Vettel should be ashamed of themselves for those comments.
They're ashamed. He said he should be ashamed of themselves for blaming this on me.
Yes.
And I'm like, wow, really? Oh dear. It's like, I can't put this into words because this is the kind of thing where I want to blow up with uncontrollable rage, and then you realize it just isn't worth it because Max, I just don't think he knows any better at this point. I just think all he's ever known is just really aggressive junior level driving. I mean, we are talking about a guy
and that, success,
yeah, and success, and basically having smoke blown up your ass for the last 2.5 years. You know, where
is this potentially, Dre? You know, we talked about this obviously during the race because it was getting to a point where I'm literally sitting there. Whenever anyone tries to attack Max, it was for 11th place. I'm literally going, oh, for crying out loud, he's nearly trying to run the guy off the track. I'm like, this is not aggressive. This is the sort of driving that if it was in NASCAR, he'd be put straight in the wall by one of the veterans to be put in his place.
Yeah, exactly.
Like a complete lack of... And for me at this point in time, I think what's frustrating, Dre, and I think we talked a little bit about this, it's just, I mean, I love aggressive driving as much as anyone. That's why I really like watching Sergio Perez drive or Graham Rahal. I love aggressive driving and I love confidence. That's great. I love a young talent. However, Dre, are we seeing here the kind of chickens come home to roost, if you will, in that Verstappen has known nothing but unending hype and praise since he was about 15 years old. And he's because he is now being painted as the savior of the entire sport. He's the exciting shot no one needs. No one is daring to kind of tap him on the shoulder and go, you do realize there's a thing called driver mutual respect, right? And at the moment, you're driving like you don't care if someone else gets hurt racing you. And that is one of the, in terms of driver etiquette, you know, driver code, if you will, that's one of the big unspoken no-nos. And for me, I said this to you, if Kimi Raikkonen, who's probably the most old school guy on the grid, if he's saying you're being a bit irresponsible, Yeah.
He did the MotoGP equivalent of standing the bike up on the apex down the Kemmel straight at 210 miles an hour.
That was so scary.
Like, I'm not even joking. Max was 6 inches away from a simply horrifying accident.
Raikkonen was 6 inches away from takeoff.
Yeah. We would have seen probably something resembling Mark Webber at Valencia 2010, where he just flies over the back of Aki Kovalainen's rear wing.
I think one of the comments, I think it was before that incident happened, where Martin Brundle says on the commentary, where he says, Max Verstappen doesn't know how to pick fights. He picks every fight.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a great way of putting it.
Yeah, he's the kind of guy that even if you touch his juice box, he will punch you in the nose, and he's unrepentant, and he will say it was his fault. He came towards me, and it's frustrating. Like, what frustrates me more is that he takes zero responsibility for these actions. Either it's always the other guy's fault, and whenever somebody calls him out on these situations, he'll go back and he'll come with some really immature remark like, Like, I remember when Felipe Massa did this, like a couple, I think it was last year, when Massa says he's got to prove he's really, really good now because he's picked a couple of, you know, big fights here. Verstappen was like...
It must have been after Monaco, wasn't it, where he drove over the back of Roman Grosjean.
Yeah, exactly. And Massa said, and Verstappen says in response, well, look at you at Canada 2014 and what you did to Sergio Perez that day. And I'm like, that doesn't really hold up when you think about it. And it's always the other guys, like you mentioned.
That's the classic sort of...
it's petulant.
It's like a sort of, is it the straw man argument? You know, where exactly. It's just like, oh, well, you can't talk. You did something kind of similar. And it's like, well, no, we're not talking about that.
That's an ad hominem argument where you don't argue, you know, you don't argue the argument. You argue the person, which you shouldn't do.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
It's like,
Andre, said something really pertinent. I love what you said here. You said, if he's young enough, if he's, you know, the whole saying of if he's good enough, he's old enough to be an F1.
Right.
He's also old enough to take responsibility.
Exactly. He's a grown-ass man. He's 18 years old. By any, by almost any law in any country, he's a grown adult. And I said this on Twitter earlier today. I said, if you're good enough, you're young enough, to which my response is, oh, don't worry about the accident. It's only his age. He'll get better. You can't have this both ways. You can't ignore the age of somebody coming into Formula One and then use it to defend him if he ends up not going to plan. You can't have that both ways. And I can't stand the fact that he's so petulant in these post-race interviews where after Germany with Nico Rosberg, where, you know, he turned across the braking zone, which Jenson Button said post-race is the most dangerous thing you can do as a racing driver in a race. He's like, oh, look.
He's been doing that for three races now. Do you remember Hungary?
Exactly.
Yeah. Goodness me.
He did it to Raikkonen. And then Verstappen said after the race, well, look what Rosberg did in Austria. And I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about?
It's like safe is always unsafe. Just because somebody else did it doesn't make it safe.
Like, just because this guy had an incident before doesn't make your incident any less or more dangerous. It's like, it's an isolated incident. It's a fixed point in time. You can't go back and change that. And, like, Verstappen, the most annoying thing about this to me is that he's not even been investigated for any of these incidents yet.
And he's getting a free ride.
The stewards have exonerated him of any and all blame. And I don't blame Verstappen for not changing his ways. He hasn't got a reason to right now. He wins these fights he keeps picking. The stewards are letting him get away with it. So, and of course, you've got, like, you may have seen this during the red flag. He talks to Christian Horner about the lap one incident, and they're blaming Sebastian Vettel for it.
Oh, my God.
It's like you could, like, they had the hard camera in there. You could hear what was being said, and they were saying it was Vettel's fault for sweeping around the outside when Verstappen is literally off the track trying to get past turn one. It's like, it doesn't help that, like I said, Verstappen is an incredibly talented driver. He's an incredible talent for 18 years of age. I will say this to the cows come home. He's got a circle of yes men around him, a bunch of fans that are so gooey-eyed over this guy that he's never going to get criticized over it.
I mean, let's be real. This is the guy who effectively, his dad said, oi, Red Bull, give us a seat at Red Bull or we're going elsewhere. And they did it. They didn't even wait till the end of the year. They just demoted Kvyat, gave it to him next race.
Yeah.
That's all he's known. It's like, I want this now, and he's got it. Because he's that good. Because he's the golden boy.
He's F1's version of Richie Rich. He's a spoilt brat in terms of how he's gotten this far in F1. Now, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. Hey, take what you're given at the end of the day. You get yours, but at the same time, you're not exonerated from driver standards just because people want you to do well. Like, that's not how anything works in sport. And
as I say, the whole thing, it reminded me a little bit. He is starting to remind me now, and Joey Logano had this problem over more years. Obviously, in NASCAR, Joey Logano had a few years. He was still the young guy, but he ended up picking fights with Ryan Newman, mm-hmm. Kevin Harvick. He was the sort of young, antsy guy who just didn't know when it was his problem. And he kept going. Obviously, at Penske, he's been a lot stronger. But the whole thing last year with Matt Kenseth, ugly as it was, it was so telling that when Kenseth walled him at Martinsville, in Payback, all the other drivers you heard on the radios after, they all just said, was anyone surprised? Because effectively what had happened is Joey Logano had been given a pass for dumping Matt Kenseth out of Kansas and effectively eliminating him from the championship. And then the CEO of NASCAR goes on the radio and says, that's exactly what our sport's about. So Matt Kenseth sat there going, well, you ain't going to do anything about it because you think this guy's, this young talent's the great guy and he's basically allowed to drive people however he wants. So I'm going to do it myself. And that's where we heard talk of driver code in inverted commas. You know,
the unwritten, like, rules.
It's the great, the unspoken rules. It's, there is a respect thing. And I mean, I was thinking about this earlier. Think about back in 2012 where Vettel and Alonso are having their great battle. Or, you know, we saw this last year in the British Touring Cars as well. Gordon Shedden coming through the field. Mm. You know, people were not flat out just getting out of his way, but Shedden had earned that much respect, and same with Vettel in 2012. Both of those guys had earned so much respect in the paddock over the years that people were looking at him going, he's in the title fight, isn't he? I'm not.
I'm not going to pick today because exactly, there's going to be some consequences.
Let's be honest here. If Verstappen was in the championship picture this year, no one would be doing that at the final round. They'd be sitting there going, Max, you can sit right there, mate.
Like, I like to bring this back to what Dre was talking about, how he wasn't even investigated. Like, this weekend, the three Stewart panel stewarding the race had two former drivers.
Go on. Who were they?
Well, the first, the non-driver, was Dr. Jared Isner. I forget which race he stewarded before. The only reason was because there was a stewarding issue at that race, so I looked up who was stewarding. That's the only reason I know.
And who were the two drivers?
So who were the two drivers stewarding this time?
Felipe Giafone, he never raced in F1. I know he raced in IndyCar. He raced back in the IRL days from 2000 to 2006. Right. And the other one is also a former F1 driver, but he's also more famously known for what he did in Indy, Danny Sullivan.
Ah.
Interesting.
I see.
Yeah. So, you know, Mr. Spin and Win.
Spin and Win.
But, yeah, I mean, it is getting dangerous now, isn't it? It just feels to me like Max is basically driving as if he kind of isn't really aware of the potential consequences of how he drives, and more to the point, doesn't care.
But it's
like a real sort of
"fuck
you, got mine" kind of style of driving. Like, yeah, exactly. He hasn't felt any yet.
Yeah, and I think Kimi was on the money. I think it's going to take a horrendous accident for this to change, and that's. And that's the
for
one
him.
Thing you.
I don't even think him causing a crash for someone else is going to get him to change. I think it's going to literally be a case of he's going to have to be involved in something horrible. I hope he doesn't get hurt out of it.
Of course.
And only then maybe something, because it's one of those things. It's almost like a weird analogy, but it's almost like if you've got a friend who's dating someone who's just no good for them, you can tell them that a million times and it's not going to get through to them. It's only when they get cheated on or get dumped or whatever that they kind of go, okay, dude, you were right. But you kind of have to have it happen to you.
But hasn't Verstappen already been in a pretty horrific incident?
Yeah.
Yeah, Monaco last year. That was one of them.
Yeah. And he hit that turn one wall at 170 miles an hour, and that didn't do a damn thing. So
Can I just say, I have a feeling that I'm going to call it right now that maybe by the end of this year, if not next year, Verstappen will be the next guy to be suspended one race, like Grosjean was in 2012.
You've got to remember, he's got 9 penalty points in his license as well.
Yeah, he's got 9 penalty points on his license, but this race he got 0 for, and like, the stewards clearly show leaning towards not penalizing Max Verstappen.
Yeah,
I think that's obvious.
It's becoming a thing now. It's happened too many times to call it sheer coincidence at this point. But that's just it's just all kinds of frustrating. It's like we want to see Verstappen do well. He is the future of this sport, whether we like him or not. And
we love aggressive driving. We love hard racing. I mean, we're going to talk about that in IndyCar at Texas. I mean, we all love hard racing, but there is a fine line between. Yes, and there's driving, racing someone hard but with respect, and racing someone like you literally don't care about what happens to them if they crash because of what you've done. And when you've got Verstappen running people clean off the road, as he did multiple times at Les Combes, nearly as throwing some outrageous blocks under braking and at 210 down the Kemmel straight, dive bombing all over, it is literally getting to a point where you can tell, especially the senior drivers like Kimi, they're like, this guy just does not give a fuck about us.
Yeah.
And that is the fastest way to rub the rest of the garage up the wrong way.
Yeah, even Niki Lauda even said something where he said drivers mustn't put each other in danger unnecessarily. He went over the limit when he didn't need to. The boy lacks the insight to see that he has made a mistake.
Yeah.
Absolutely agree.
Old man Louder is coming out here teaching these youngins some new tricks. let's move on from Max Verstappen real quick. I want to talk about one more little thing from this race, and that was the grid penalties that came up. And back of the field after the qualifying, Fernando Alonso, that had to have an engine replaced in free practice one, they did that twice over. So Fernando Alonso had 55 places worth of grid penalties. He actually very funnily took the piss out of himself for this one by posting a picture on Instagram with the grid turned upside down, with Alonso and Hamilton in the front. It was a very 2007 kind of vibe I was getting there from Instagram, with Alonso and Hamilton up the front. And Lewis Hamilton, now we got wind of this on Thursday that he was going to take at least one engine penalty at this Grand Prix and take 10 places as a result, but 10 quickly became 20, 25, 30. Yeah, I'm going to skip. It got to 60. 60, 60 places of grid penalties because they replaced the engine, the complete engine, I think, twice over, and they had a gearbox seal go missing. So that was another five-place grid penalty. So Hamilton had 60 places of grid penalties. Now, normally we just kind of laugh this off and move on, but there was a key significant reason why Hamilton took those grid penalties, King.
Oh, I'm not specifically sure on the technical details of why he wanted to take.
Yeah, sorry, I'll take this one. I get to sound smart. I get to be the smart one on this podcast for once.
Yeah.
Basically,
it doesn't happen very often.
No, it really doesn't. I'm normally just a charismatic whack job, but today I get to be Captain Clever. But what happened? Okay, here's how this works. This is what I've read from Rachel Brooks and other people in F1. For every engine that they used to replace the one that was going through, they get to use another version of the same engine later on in the calendar for free without a penalty.
Oh, yeah.
So if they upgrade the engine between now and the end of the season, then they'll have to take a grid penalty at that race. But as long as they keep the specification the same, for every engine you replace that weekend, you get to use another one later in the year for free. So if you're a team like Mercedes, who have an almost limitless pool of cash, they have no problem replacing the same engine twice in a weekend. So now, Hamilton has only lost 10 points by finishing third. He's still leading the championship, and now he has three engines in the bank for the rest of the season.
Yeah, because in actuality, it is the same engine. They're just rebuilding it.
Exactly. They're just rebuilding, using new parts to rebuild the same allocation. So essentially, they now have three new engines to play with between now and the end of the season. So three engines without penalty over the next, there's only seven rounds to go now. Eight rounds to go, I should say, sorry. But the engine grid penalty factor, King, is essentially gone.
I don't know. Of course, it doesn't sound as severe when you say, oh, he should have a 60-place grid penalty, but he's only starting from the back.
Exactly.
When I think the terminology is mixed up. They should, just call it a terminal grid penalty or something and just ignore the fact that it's, quote-unquote, 60 places.
I mean, it's an interesting thing. They changed the rule at the end of last season because they were kind of sick and tired of McLaren having these stupidly high grid penalty counts almost every weekend. So they got rid of the rules. Before then, the rule was, if I'm not mistaken, if you had leftover grid penalties you couldn't take, you were given a penalty during the race. For example, I think it was a drive through at one point. There was a 10-second stop-go penalty. I think if you hadn't served more than 10 grid places, something like that.
Yes.
And they got rid of that for this season because they felt like it was unfair on the teams that way. So, of course, Mercs took advantage of this little loophole in the rules now, and now they've got three engines to spare.
I don't know. Even if they would have had leftover grid penalties, they still would have done it. Stop and go, they still would have done it. They're Mercedes.
Yeah, exactly. They're Mercedes.
They're Mercedes, and they do what they want.
Yeah, and they have the ability to make recoveries like this. And any hope you had of Hamilton not winning this title, I think, is pretty much gone now. So, enjoy the rest of this charity drive for the rest of the season. I'm going to watch IndyCar. Oh, there's only two rounds left. Fuck! fuck! Oh, shit.
This is damn it, IndyCar.
Wait. Formula E's coming back.
Oh, great. Sebastian Buemi dominates all of season three. Fantastic. Thanks a bunch, Chase.
And they aren't coming back to London this year, which I realised as I was hanging out in Battersea Park today. I'm like, I missed the two London E-Prix. They're not coming back in. Damn it.
But guess who's coming to take over Brooklyn?
Oh,
hey,
Formula E.
Well, it certainly beats their terrible basketball franchise.
It almost makes it sound like Sebastian Buemi's going to be coming round to win, and then Bobby Roode's just going to walk out and turn off his car.
Yeah.
Just standing in the middle of the main straight in his robe.
Yes. A very Ric Flair. But that's pretty much all of the talk from Belgium. Let's talk about IndyCar. And IndyCar...
Yes, please, can we?
And after an 11-week delay, we finally got to finish the Texas Firestone 600. this was a classic. And it wasn't for the first 170 laps, but... All I will say is, holy shit, that finish.
In reality, it was the final 10 laps. All
nine laps. Yeah, it was a 9-lap sprint to the finish. We'll explain how they got there real quick. I mean, James Hinchcliffe had a rocket ship for a car this round. There is no other way of describing it. He had a comfortable multiple second lead at the front of the field. No one could keep up with him except for Ed Carpenter, who for all of a sudden seemed to think it was 2008 again. Throwback Ed Carpenter was here. And Carpenter was back. He was in. He'd worked his way up into second place. He was actually legitimately chasing Hinchcliffe down. Gap was about a second. But coming out of the pits on a fresh set of tyres was Scott Dixon. And because Carpenter's tyres were used, he wasn't as fast. Dixon had the faster car. Dixon was desperate to try and unlap himself and try and get back on the lead lap. And bang. Basically on the home straight into turn one. And it's an interesting one, King, because like they initially all thought it was Carpenter's fault boxing him in. The replay kind of showed Dixon may have pushed up a little bit. I mean, what's your take on it?
I want to put the majority of the blame on Ed Carpenter. Like that wasn't his first. Yes. That wasn't his first dangerous move of the race.
No, Carpenter was very aggressive in this race. He was basically going full Sage Karam out here, which is quite funny when you think about what happened last season. But I tweeted during the race. Someone Ed into the wall. You know he loves that.
Oops.
But not like that, Dixon. But I think Carpenter boxed Dixon in. Like there was no need for Carpenter to be in the middle of the track that close. In that situation, there was still about, I think, 40 or so laps to go in the race at the time. It was an unnecessary move from Carpenter. I mean, you don't lose anything by letting Dixon through. Hinchcliffe's on the lead lap here. Like, let Dixon go off to Hinchcliffe. Like, you don't need to race him. But hey, Ed Carpenter, everybody. Maybe you can make the argument that racing justice was served about 20 laps later. But Dixon was taken out. Thankfully, his wife didn't call the entire series a rig again. God bless her.
oh, dear.
But Dixon did come out of the car and gave us... We had our first legit willpower moment.
yes, we had a legit willpower moment. To be honest, Scott Dixon was like the last person I expected that from.
Peter Perfect has hopped out of the car and given the double bird salute. I'm like, okay, Dixon must really be pissed.
fun story here. Basically, I had the journey home from hell Saturday night. It was so bad that I left where I was. I was at a friend's birthday night out, and tube let me down, missed all my last trains, phone completely died, ended up having to get some ridiculous 3-hour combination of night buses and walk to get home. And as if it couldn't be any worse, I literally got in as the Texas race finished. So, but in the catch up afterwards, Dre happened to mention about the whole thing with Scott Dixon flipping the double bird, and I literally went, you kidding me? Scott Dixon doesn't flip the birds at people, he's classier than that.
He's clearly still mad about Toronto. Clearly, he's like, it's all just spilled over. He snapped. Maybe somebody kicked his dog or something. I don't know. But yeah, Dixon.
It's probably because the fact that he's officially not in the championship contention anymore, which is unheard of.
Yeah.
Like Scott Dixon is always there or thereabouts.
Yep, exactly. It's just not gone Dixon's way this year at all. And the salt kind of continued afterwards because like Robin Miller found him and interviewed him after the race. And Dixon said, and I quote, "It was like Carpenter was driving without a spotter."
Like he asked, and he tried to be as sincere as possible and asked, "Was his radio broken?"
That's such a subtle beat, isn't it? Like, I mean, Jesus Christ.
Can I just clarify, did you actually have eyes for that race?
Jesus. It was incredible sass. Yeah, just an incredible moment there. As Carpenter pretty much boxes Dixon into oblivion. There's something like 27 like laps to go or so. So a lot of the field comes in for new tires. Hinchcliffe sticks it out on his fairly new but actually still at a disadvantage kind of set. We restart again, and then as if the racing gods had seen what had happened, Carpenter spins it and is out.
And we don't normally like the term karma, but hey.
Okay, I hope the grid girls and the IndyCar fan girls aren't listening to this segment, but there was a lot of people rooting for Ed Carpenter to win this one, and I may or may not have smiled as Carpenter got out of his car. Like, obviously, I was hoping he was okay. He was okay. Then I smiled. I was like...
But we all know. I mean, the fact of the matter is both of those incidents were Charlie Kimball's fault.
Yes. It was absolutely Charlie Kimball's fault. It's just... Oh, God, joke is that Rendrick wasn't... It's not going to die anytime soon, is it? But Carpenter spins out. There's another yellow... next thing you know, Michaela Lotion, who had overtaken Hinchcliffe and was able to get back on the lead lap on a brand new set of tyres, all of a sudden a Lotion was the threat. It's like, will the Mad Russian finally win this one? They restart, a Lotion gets boxed wide, he's on the dirty side of the track, he spins out. So the biggest threat for the win in Michaela Lotion, through no real fault of his own, has been taken out, essentially. So there's another caution. And that leads us to where we were talking at the start of this segment. There is 9 laps to go.
Potentially the greatest last 9 laps in racing history.
Yeah, like, to picture the scene, there is 9 laps to go in Texas. There is only 5 men on the lead lap. There is a rule at IndyCar, in the final 10 laps of a race, the lapped cars are shuffled to the back of the field. So basically, the guys that are a lap down or more are not allowed to interfere in this leading fight. And that, because Alexander Rossi was getting involved quite heavily early on in previous restarts, even though he was 3 laps down. He had no chance of winning the race whatsoever. But of course, he has to just get in there and mess with people. So there was only 5 men who had a chance of winning this race. And realistically, it was only really 4, because Helio Castroneves still had broken part of his car as a result of the Carpenter incident.
But so, I just have to mention, that restart, the back straight 4 wide, oh my God.
Oh my God.
It is a 4-way dogfight at this one between James Hinchcliffe, Tony Kanaan, Graham Rahal.
Hinch had broken out a small lead. This was from...
Oh, this is the first 4 wide. They went 4 wide twice.
Yeah, they went 4 wide twice.
Yeah, there was one earlier.
Yeah,
because
it was the Castroneves, Pagano, Kanaan, and Rahal. And that was where Rahal actually got bounced between two of them. It was basically 200 miles an hour pinball.
Yeah. Somehow they all didn't, like, somehow none of them wrecked. I'm still astonished that no one wrecked as a result of those 4 wides. But that was another one.
Superb driving, you've got to say.
Stunning driving from everybody involved. That there wasn't a humongous accident. But there was another 4 wide. It was the 4 guys that were eligible for the win, not barring Helio's damaged car, was James Hinchcliffe, Tony Kanaan, Simon Pagenaud, and Graham Rahal. They went 4 wide down the back straight, and Pagenaud, in what might be a championship winning decision, decided to back off.
Yeah.
It's as if suddenly in front of him flashed his point lead and willpower slowly gaining on him, and he just went,
No,
I'm not going to do this.
Oh, Jesus. It was...
Can I just point out as well, like, NASCAR are closed wheel and are more akin to, like, go 3-4 wide, whatever, because, hey, they can bounce off each other and have less damage. Mm-hmm. I've not even seen them go 4 wide as they did at Texas in the IndyCar.
Unbelievable.
This was mind-blowing.
Yeah,
it was greater than the 5 wide at Fontana. For me, it's greater than the 7 wide at Pocono last year. Just they were running that close to each other at 200 in a corner at 205 miles an hour. And
let's be honest, a track that for IndyCar is far narrower than Pocono and Fontana.
Yes,
way narrower.
It's way narrower. The banking is steeper. It's all kinds of crazy and. It went down right the way to the very last lap. Graham Rahal basically dive-bombed Hinchcliffe on the penultimate corner in a I'm coming through whether your car is here or not kind of manoeuvre. Like, I'm going to sacrifice my car to try and win this damn race. And Rahal was...
Because that's just what Rahal does.
He's fearless. He has no concept of the term fear whatsoever. None. He just dive bombs Hinchcliffe down the inside. Hinchcliffe is, you know, he's like, okay, I'm going to try and run this around the outside and maybe I'll get there. And he just misses out. If the finish line is maybe 100 yards further out, he might have just gotten there. But Graham Rahal wins, leading a grand total of...
Having started celebrating 50 yards from the line.
Yeah, that's what would have cost them the win.
We nearly saw Motorsport's Lindsay Jacobellis moment.
Oh, dear God.
I think...
He started pumping his fist in the air a good 2 seconds before he crossed the line. Yeah. And part of me just wishes I could hear his reaction just as he starts to pump his fist thinking, he's got it. And then he just looks at his mirror as he crosses the line and sees Hinch's car dead heating with him.
I'd have died laughing.
Just the sound of him just going...
I think it was Paul Tracy who mentioned it. Like, you know, like sticking your entire arm out of the cockpit adds like 10 pounds of drag on the car.
That's a very good point. Yeah, that's a very good point. I didn't realize that. Yeah, because they're traveling at 210 miles an hour over the finish line. That's going to make a difference. And Hinchcliffe very nearly got it. I'd say, looking at the photo, about 11 inches, maybe between rail and inch. Like, we're talking inches here. It was
the width of a front wing.
The width of a front wing, 0.01 of a second between Rahal and Hinchcliffe over the line. It is the 5th closest finish in IndyCar history and the closest finish in IndyCar since, I think it was Chicago in 2009.
Yeah, the upside down transponder.
The upside down transponder between Dixon and Helio Castroneves, that incident. It's very funny.
Like all these close finishes always have something to remember them by. This one is like the Graham raised arm. The last one was the upside down transponder.
Honestly, Rahal looks like a fucking hero for that now. But if he had lost that race on that fist bump, oh my, I would have died laughing. As John said, that would have been like your Lindsay Jacobellis moment right there and then. Now, for those guys who know what I'm talking about, it happened in the Winter Olympics in 2006 in Turin, where she's about to win the women's snowboard cross. She's got a massive lead on Tanya Farida. She gets to the final jump. She thought, I'm going to stunt a little bit here. She goes for a method in midair. She misses the landing. She falls over, and Tanya Farida goes on to win with Jacobellis demoted to second. And it is without question the funniest sporting blooper, I think, in history.
I don't think I've laughed that hard at any sporting event. Probably the only one that came close may have been the 2014 FIFA World Cup semi-final.
Oh, God.
I mean, but that was just sustained hilarity for 25 minutes of carnage.
Oh, God.
But that was the first Winter Olympics I properly watched, because I remember I was very ill at the time and I was off school, so I ended up watching a lot of the Winter Olympics, mostly bedridden. And I just remember leaning forward. I really enjoyed snowboard cross. It's one of my favourite events at the Winter Olympics. And I remember thinking, well, she's just got this one in the bag. And as soon as I saw her stack, I just sort of looked at the top of the screen and saw the second place rider come into view and start to go... No, she didn't. Oh my Christ. And I literally just almost died laughing.
If you ever listen to the British version of that clip, it's Ed Lee doing the commentary, and he's the most over-enthusiastic man on earth. He just screams, "Frida! Frida!" It's like watching Mel Gibson in Braveheart all over again. It's just, "Frida!" It's like, it's going to be played on American sporting bloopers for years to come. Like, the British were just stunting on the Americans right there. Like that was our most patriotic moment ever right there. We get a chance to take a pot shot at the Americans. And Ray Hall very nearly got caught hot dogging. I think
it was almost like a version of, King, you might be able to help me out with this. From a GP2, I want to say, race from 2003, Monaco.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody slowed down to celebrate before the start-finish line, didn't actually cross the finish line to win the race.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Christ, that who was it? It's not Benaldi. It wasn't Benaldi.
God, I don't remember. It was brutal.
Oh, I'm sure someone will figure it out between now and the end of the show, but... the way we got there, and we can't say this enough, one of the greatest finishes I've ever seen.
Bjorn Wertheim. Sorry to cut across you, Bjorn Wertheim.
Okay. Yeah, there you go. That's
2003 Formula 3000 at Monaco.
There you
he
go.
Slowed down to celebrate with his crew, but didn't actually cross the line.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
That was very nearly Ray Hall.
Oh, so nearly. Again, 0.01 of a second breathing. But believe me when I tell you that the race is already on YouTube. The last 9 laps specifically are already on YouTube. Please, whatever you do, I will not recommend this enough. Go out of your way to watch those final 9 laps. It is without question some of the greatest racing you will ever see. Like I said to, on one of my race review on Twitter, I said, it's a 10 out of 10. Fuck conventional scoring. You have to see that finish. It's
like, just mind-bogglingly good. It is literally the case of, like, I mean, I obviously have a few clips that I show to people who aren't that much into oval racing or, you know, NASCAR or IndyCar or something. Literally at that point, you're never going to be into oval racing if you didn't find something to enjoy in those final 9 laps.
Yes.
It is remarkable. And basically... it was 200 mile an hour Kieran.
Yes, basically.
And
where's Jason Kenny when you need him?
He was actually at Brands Hatch that same day, the same weekend.
Crazy.
That's why I had to come over and see you. If he turned up at Brands Hatch with Laura Trott, it would have actually broken the restraining order. I'd have been too close because I live like 5 miles away from the circuit
and the restraining order for
10 miles. So I had to leave Swanley for the day.
I was doing you a favour.
I had to leave Swanley for the day.
Yeah.
But it's just... wow, you can't, like, if you don't like oval racing after that, we can't help you. And if you still want to claim that it's boring and doesn't take any skill, get lost.
Oh, you gotta watch that. If you think that takes no skill.
If you think that takes no skills, you're just a hater. You're just a bitter, like bitter hate.
It's hilarious. At this point in time, I basically, especially from my friends who aren't into racing that much, I know I have them. I literally have to explain to people what IndyCar is. And I basically say, shorthand answer, it's American Formula One, but better than Formula One.
Yeah.
And then literally, like, we were talking to someone at Robot Wars last night.
Yeah.
She's Canadian. And Dre just said, we've got to get her into IndyCar via the medium of Hinch.
Yes.
And that seems to be going well so far. And literally, it was at that point
it's
I was
working.
Like, well, here's your introduction to IndyCar, the most recent race.
Yeah.
Yes. Where your boy was 0.08 away from winning what would have been one of the greatest IndyCar races ever seen.
You felt for him after as well.
Hinch led for literally months. And
3 months.
Yeah, 3 months. And Graham Rahal only led the last lap.
Graham Rahal, you look at the stats board, Graham Rahal laps led one, the final lap of the race. That.
Graham Rahal at this point is like Edge, just cashing in at the last.
And you know what?
Cashing in on a downed opponent.
You know what I hate? He was the smuggest motherfucker on earth when he was talking about the win. He even took time out of his precious schedule of grandstanding to throw shade at Helio. And I'm like, you are such a smug git. You know that?
And then compare that to Hinch just down pit road.
Devastated.
His boy Connor Daly, his bro Connor Daly had been on pit reporter duty because obviously he'd been eliminated from the first running of the race. So he was out effectively. He didn't even start. So they got him on pit road reporting duty. And I thought he did very well, I've got to say.
He was amazing.
And he was one of the guys first on the scene to interview him. And you could just see, like, both were trying to be professional, but Connor was just really wanting to be like, bruh, have a hug, man. Have a bro hug. You need it.
Yeah, and you know what? Like, the sportsmanship on the display, not from Rahal really because he was too busy celebrating, but Hinchcliffe and Kanaan hugged it out really tight after the race, and Like, Kanaan is a proper, like, driver's driver in that regard, where, you know, he supports other guys. And I know he and Hinch are very, very good friends, and they have a lot of respect for each other. And you could see just how devastated Hinchcliffe was that he doesn't enable him. And he led 188 out of 248 laps in a race that was delayed from the lead for 3 months. And he's never looked as good in an IndyCar until this race right here. And he finished in second. I just... That's
Hinch, we're sending you hugs, man.
Yeah, Hinch, I love think you, need man. It. And, and
especially Dre, who's the full-on Hinch fan here. Like, I consider myself a Graham Rahal fan, and even I was like, no.
It was 4 a.m. I was like, wow, what a finish. And then 10 seconds later, I just shouted, motherfucker.
Yeah, like, it genuinely, like, first, like, if you don't watch in slow motion, full speed, first time, you really think Hinch is going to catch him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think because he's slightly closer to the camera and the angle as they come across the line just looks like... Right.
The live shot on the hard camera made it look like Hinch had gotten there. And he just came up short.
And then he comes up on the results board. Rahal, like, first. And you're just like, what?
No! Why?
It reminded me a lot of the famous NASCAR race in 2003 at Darlington where Kurt Busch and Ricky Craven are basically locked together across the finish line. That was 0.002 of a second. And the moment, yeah, it's quite funny because they come across the line, Craven wins it by literally about the width of a water bottle, and they cut to the camera that was down in the pits of Kurt Busch's crew, and you can tell that they assume that Kurt was going to win it. So they cut to his crew expecting them to be celebrating. They're just there going, damn it. And then they have to hastily cut to Craven's pit crew on the hard camera down the other end of pit road.
You know what that was? That was replicating the most heartbreaking, one of the most heartbreaking scenes in F1 history when Lewis Hamilton wins his first world title in 2008.
Oh, God. Somewhere Skellington's just been triggered.
But like the race director has got the shot of Felipe Massa winning his seventh race of the season. And he's over the line. At that point, he is champion. And they cut to the Massa pit crew, and it's potty. They've lost their minds. They think, yes, Massa, because his whole family was in for the Grand Prix for the finale. Home
and
Grand
then there's
Prix.
Just this one guy who gets in and goes, it's his dad. Hamilton finished sixth.
It's his dad. His dad's like, wait a minute. They've forgotten. They've not seen it, because off the hard camera, Hamilton's passed Timo Glock. He's up to fifth. He's won the world title by a point. And then the devastation station in the Ferrari crew as they cut to McLaren, and they're losing their minds. It's like, oh my god!
Yeah, and then literally at that point, you just see the faces drop in the Massa pit. It's like, wait.
Like
the
one thing I won't forget is that Ferrari mechanic in the background just flipping out when he knows that Massa's lost it, and he knocks the sign off the wall.
Oh, he knocks the sign off the wall, and then. Like, Nicole Scherzinger's in there. She's bawling her eyes out. Like, Anthony Hamilton's bawling his eyes out. And the McLaren team's gone crazy. And then Felipe Massa pulls up in Parc Fermé, having won the race. And he just cries his eyes out. Because for 20 seconds, he had it. He had it. It was right there in front of him. We thought, this is it. He's going to be world champion. And he just bawls. He bawls like a baby. And I don't mean that in an insulting way. It's like... It's just the most heartbreaking scene in the world when Massa was just there, and it reminded me a lot of that. But again, Kanaan was a proper pro about the whole situation.
It was a little bit like Lutala Mohamed at the Taekwondo in the Olympics this year. He lost the gold medal match in the final second of the final round.
You should have seen that, man. It was a Taekwondo. He's got it. He's got the gold medal, and then he hits a spinning head kick at the last second, and Great Britain don't get the goal, and it's like Lutala can't believe it. It was the most incredible thing ever.
Felt so sorry for him because he was crying after. He was like, I'm sorry to everyone. I feel like I let everyone down who stayed up to watch. And I'm like, you have not let anyone down, son. Seriously. Don't get that thought out of your head right now.
Well, he was a bit sloppy on that last second, I have to say. Anyway,
you're a harsh motherfucker, Dre.
Before I get killed by a bunch of Olympians, let me run down the grid order real quick. Graham Rahal wins by, like I said, 8 thousandths of a second.
That's about, let's just time that. That's how long it is.
Like I said, he won that race by about 11 inches. That's what we're talking about. And then with cars moving at 210 miles an hour. That's how close that was. 8 fans of a second. James Hinchcliffe in second. Like I said, he led 188 of the laps in that Grand Prix and did not win. Oh, dear. Tony Kanaan in third. Kanaan's had a fantastic run of form and not talked about yet. He's not won a race this season yet, but only Will Power has scored more points in the last 7 rounds than Tony Kanaan has. Old man still got it, even at age 72. We mentioned him earlier. Like we mentioned him as well before earlier, Simon Pagenaud, who very wisely backed out of that big four wide at turn three later in the race there. He took the championship points, I think, very wisely in this instance by finishing in fourth. Helio, as we said earlier, had a damaged car, could not compete with that top four for the win, finished in fifth instead. Decent Kimball in sixth place, the best of the lap down runners there. So Kimball in sixth ahead of Carlos Munoz, Will Power in eighth, key for the title race there. Montoya, who did nothing all race long, finished in ninth ahead of Sebastian Bourdais, Alexander Rossi 11th, Marco Andretti 12th, Ryan Hunter-Reay, who was leading the early periods of the race. His car just seemed just to get worse and worse as the race went on. He was botting them out everywhere. Just another wretched bit of luck for Hunter-Reay this year in terms of the ovals. 14th, Gabby Chavez, Max Chilton in 15th, and then we get to the retirements. Michaela Lotion, as we said, he was taken out via contact with Jack Hawksworth, Polynesia's finest. Ed Carpenter, he had a collision. We mentioned he had a collision on his own. He spun out by himself, and he took out Dixon, who was 19th. Not Now Sato had an engine problem in 20th, and as we of course mentioned earlier, Connor Daly and Joseph Newgarden were not allowed to continue the restart because they were the only two DNFs in the original running of this race back in June. But again, props to Connor Daly as well. He was so good as a broadcaster. Good Lord. So good. But
yeah, it reminds me of when his dad was a pit reporter.
Yeah. Very much.
And
so.
A great co-commentator, actually, for Kart. He was really good.
Yeah.
So. He also came out with one of my favorite ever commentary lines, which was after the famous incident with Paul Tracy spinning at, I want to say, Edmonton.
Yeah, it was Edmonton.
And then rejoining and wiping out Alex Tagliani. And then you just hear Derek Daly just go, "That is the dumbest thing I have ever seen."
That is the dumbest thing I've seen Paul Tracy do.
It's like the only thing that Connor lacks from his father is the Dawson Irish tones.
Yes.
Oh, it's just wonderful, isn't it?
Like the line that he goes is like, "Tag wants him. Tag wants a piece of Tracy." And next thing you know, the two Canadians are scrapping in the middle of the pit lane. Like, literally, like, it's still one of the funniest moments in motorsport history, because of how much of a complete idiot Paul Tracy was. But on to a little bit of other news, and as I'm sure you're well aware, in the gaming world, F1 2016 hit the shelves
at the end of last week. 1 second. We got a championship picture. 2 races left.
Oh, yes. Yeah, actually, you make a very good point there, Mr. King. Yes, I was got a little bit ahead of myself there. It's easy to forget this in IndyCar, but we've only got 2 rounds to go now in the championship. We've got Watkins Glen this weekend, and then just under 3 weeks' time, the grand finale, the double point finale, may we add, at Sonoma. Yep. 100 points available for race win on the final round. So anyone within 150 points of Simon Pagenaud is technically still eligible to win this title.
So that's everyone down to 9th place in Carlos Munoz.
Yep. So everyone, sorry, Kimball, bad luck. The top 9 are all still eligible for the championship at this stands. But Simon Pagenaud has a 28-point lead over Will Power. Pagenaud with 529. Pagenaud with 529. Power with 501. Tony Kanaan is now lifted himself up into third place with 416 for Chip Ganassi Racing in the number 10 car. He's ahead of Helio Castroneves. He's 1 point behind Kanaan. Helio in fourth with 415. Newgarden, who's now going to make up for his lost round he could not finish in Texas, he's on 406 in fifth. Scott Dixon, probably out of the running now. He's on 397. That's a mere 132 points, I should say, away from Simon Pagenaud. Graham Rahal, with his win, bumps himself up into 7th place with 394 as the top Honda in the championship now, ahead of James Hinchcliffe on 392 and Carlos Munoz, who finished 7th, very quiet 7th there, in 382 in 9th. So those are your 9 championship contenders going into the final two rounds. Any one of those nine names I just mentioned can technically still win this title. Yes, even you, Munoz. But F1 2016, Johnson, how have you found it so far?
So far, first impressions are this is probably in the top three of the best Formula One games Codemasters have made. And up until now, my two favourites have been Formula One 2010, the first proper one. We're not sure we count F1 2009.
No, we don't talk about the F1 2010.
No, or the PSP one. But F1 2010 was superb, really good game. And it kind of felt like 2016 was going back to that vibe of not just having, 2015, basically, we agreed, was a magnificent tech demo for a great game engine. There was just no game. There was barely any features. There was barely no content. What content there was mostly broken, i.e. online. So that's why it got such a backlash, which is a shame because the core game itself, like the driving physics, the graphics and everything, fantastic. And so this time around, it's clear that they've said, well, you know what? Let's still polish up the graphics and the physics where we can, but let's bring back what we did so well in F1 2010, which is not just have a career mode, but properly immerse the player in the lifestyle of being an F1 driver. Let's have the backstage, the behind the scenes stuff, the conversations with your agent, the phone calls, the chats with your engineer and team boss, and upgrade points and development tokens and rivalries with your teammate, all little things like that. And to be honest with you, the fact that my first career mode race weekend session lasted about 2 hours, even though I was running on 25% race length, was incredible. And I love the fact that they've brought in, I think in a move influenced by the Milestone MotoGP games, where you get development tokens for, you know, where you get development tokens for running laps in practice. Yeah. F1 2016 has kind of taken that and gone, well, what if we also make these kind of entertaining mini games in the practice session? So, for example, if you want to do a qualifying hot lap, whatever, simulation thing, go out there, hit a lap time under the target time. There's ones for tyre conservation, which I actually thought was very interesting because you've kind of got to run laps under the target time, but also keep the bar sort of in the middle or off to the right so you're not abusing the tyres too much. All really interesting. To be honest with you, so far I've really enjoyed it. It's been very, very good. I have to say, Dre, do you agree? One of the best Codemasters F1 games.
I'm not really sure how much of a compliment that is, given a lot of them were stinkers. But in any case, yeah, it's definitely
one of them. It's up there with 2010 and 2013, certainly.
It's one of the better F1 games they've made. Yeah, I mean, online is still a little bit ropey. The AI is still terrible, unfortunately. I still can't stand the fact that they are complete chickens and they will run off the track the moment you show them a piece of front wing. They are still incredibly conservative. I still think the AI is too, like, the distance between AI difficulties, I think, is still too big.
I absolutely agree. I had an issue in my first career mode race where going into it, I was racing on expert and I was about a second a lap slower than my teammate. So I bumped down to Haas and I accidentally ended up winning the Australian Grand Prix for Haas F1.
Yes.
I kind of beat the Mercs and I'm like, are you serious?
And on paper, Haas is like the seventh best team in the field. That shouldn't be happening. And I've always had this weird problem where with a pad, like, I am too good for expert and will constantly punch above my weight in expert because I used Renault in my career mode. They are a tier three team, so they are one of the worst teams you can pick. They are the ninth best team on merit. But I finished like fourth, seventh, and third in my three career mode races I've done so far. And
on expert?
And that's on expert difficulty. If I bump it up to legend, I'm at the back. There's about a second and a half between difficulty levels in this game, and that's an enormous amount of time. I would rather.
And it's funny
because
they've actually introduced another difficulty level at the top called ultimate, or as I call it, TMT Marduk mode.
Ultimate difficulty is like a second and a half faster than legend difficulty. Like, ultimate is for literally the best of the best. It's for people like Noble, basically, at this point.
Yes.
It's not meant for regular souls like you and me. And again, that's like legend, but with another second and a half thrown in. It's ridiculous.
So they didn't make it more nuanced by adding a new difficulty. They just added, like, instead of, you know, adding more options, they just, you know, put 11 on it.
Basically, it was the Spinal Tap of difficulty in games. Basically, thought, We'll keep the previous ones as the same. We're just going to add a seventh one in there just to fuck with some YouTubers, basically. Like, ultimately, like I said, it's about a second and a half on top of Legend, and they've got a new very easy difficulty level in there as well for complete amateurs, which, again, if you're playing the difficulty, then what's the frigging point, quite frankly?
But, what are you doing even playing this game? Maybe you should go back to Wii Sports.
Yeah, seriously. Like, I wish they would have a Project Cars-like slider where... Like, there is a much more variable range of difficulty. Something that, you know, feels realistic, yet you can still, you know, fight above your means if you are good enough. And I know that's kind of a difficult thing to really do and to program and code, but the current difficulty settings, that there is so... It's so hard to find a happy medium, because if it's too easy, you're going to win a race by half a minute, and if it's too difficult, you're going to be constantly defending from faster cars for the entire Grand Prix, and that's not fun either. That was basically the backbone of my YouTube career when I was doing it with Sauber, where I was qualifying really well and finishing second and have a bunch of rampaging Mercedes and Ferraris and McLarens behind me every single race. That still annoys me. The game's handling model, though, is really nice. I like the fact, like, again, the career mode, I think overall is pretty darn good. I think it's about as good as you can make an F1 career mode realistic. I love the customization. You've got a proper physical moving avatar now. No female, which is a little bit of an annoying option that they don't include.
I didn't notice that. Yeah, that's annoying.
I'm a bit disappointed. If Milestone can do it, there's no reason why Cody's can do it. So disappointed there's no female driver. I like the fact that you can have your own custom number and helmet. That's a nice touch. The resource points and how development works is excellent. You know, you get points, again, for taking part in practice-based mini-games. We mentioned this earlier. By taking part in more sessions, you get more points. You can go down any one of five avenues for development, like the engine to downforce, working on the drag of the car, working on engine efficiency. And down the road, you get more interesting options. Like, you can stop development on your car altogether after Singapore, whereas you get 25% more resource points if you stop development on the car. But obviously the main downside being is you cannot develop the car anymore that season. So if you want to go for the big season 2 increase or the big next season update instead, or if you're confident about where your car is, you can stop altogether for a bonus. Little things like that are quite good. And again, the career mode is excellent. The gameplay is excellent for the most part. I think the handling model is very good. The cars are very enjoyable to drive. The AI is still terrible, but... again, that's just Cody's being Cody's at this point, really. The online is still
a little bit weird, given how good the AI is in the grid games. I really enjoyed the grid autosport AI. Very aggressive, but you felt like you could race them. Kind of like the Forza AI.
Yeah, it's like the best AI is the AI you don't notice, in my opinion. Mm. And the ones that like the F1, where that's just so conservative, that is what I don't like. And like that. But overall, I'll have a full review of the game out on YouTube later this month. Probably like early September, I will have a review of the game out in full. I've got to dust off my brother's old laptop and wire up my capture card again for the first time in over a year. But
the nostalgia.
Yeah, the nostalgia, yes indeed. But I will be doing that very soon, so keep an eye tuned on the YouTube channel for that as time goes on. But overall, for what it's worth, if you're an F1 fan, it's definitely a game worth picking up. It's about as... realistically, it's about as good as a Cody's game they can realistically make right now. I would still like to see them try and get extra content in there, like the 2013's Classic Edition.
That was brilliant.
But had all of the older cars, bonus tracks, a proper scenario mode. Like, that was the most complete F1 experience they've put out on a disc ever, in my opinion. So that, I think, is still the standard they're trying to chase. But the foundation is getting more solid by the year. So hopefully next year they'll tidy up some of these issues and have... I think 2017 has got potentially the best F1 game ever. I hope so. I mean, I think if they listen to the community like they did this year, to their credit, then I think this game was definitely a step in the right direction in any case. So more on that in my video later this month. That just about does it for this episode of Motorsport 101. I hope you guys enjoyed the three of us back together. Again, if you want to find us anywhere, again, you can back us on Patreon. That's patreon.com/Motorsport101. We are on Facebook at facebook.com/Motorsport101. I really should post more on there, to be honest with you. That's kind of my fault, really. We are all individually on Twitter at Harrison101HD, at AJ_BomberSports, and at Ryan Eric King. And of course, for exclusive content, including the Dre Brief series and video highlights, highlights of the podcast, check us out on YouTube at youtube.com/motorsport101. And I think I can say we have just crossed 900 subscribers. So thank you all very much for the support on there as well. So thank you very much for that. So on the way to our first 1,000, that'd be pretty cool.
Ooh, yeah.
But yeah, thanks everyone for backing us on YouTube and supporting us on there. We're very much grateful for it. So until next time, I've been Andre Harrison. He's been Adam Johnson and Ryan King. And I'll see you guys next time. Sayonara.
Like, I'm not really.
You are.